Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Joel Diamond is an American producer and music executive. Through a series of being in the right places at the right times, Joel jump-started his professional career as the head of MRC Music, publishing division of Mercury Records. Using his keen instincts, his devotion to music, people skills, and high standards, which he had developed along the way, and through working in the family business, he immediately scored several number one records for the company. He also hired as his assistant a then unknown Tommy Mottola, who later became the longest running president of CBS Records and married Mariah Carey. It wasn't long thereafter that Joel's achievements at MRC Music caught the attention of industry titan Clive Davis, who recruited him to head up Sony, April Blackwood Music, as well as making Joel part of Clive's personal A&R staff. Not only did Joel sign notable and multi-platinum new acts, he also fostered the careers of emerging talents as well as other already notable Sony Music writers such as James Taylor, Harry Nilsson, Barry Manilow, and Laura Nero. It was during this period of time that the president of Polydor Records, Jerry Schoenbaum, enticed Joel with an offer of starting his own record label, along with the additional incentive of writing and producing his own records. Silver Blue Records was born, and right off the gate came a number one on the R&B charts with Joel at the helm producing, writing, and publishing. Coming full circle and returning back to Sony Music, Columbia Records at the time, Joel was offered a distribution deal for his Silver Blue Records label, and he began his new affiliation with two number one records, which he also produced for artists Gloria Gaynor and David Hasselhoff. Certainly one of the apexes of Joel's career has been the 12 successful albums and 109 recordings he produced for legendary recording artist Engelbert Humperdinck, which included Engelbert's biggest record and copyright owned at the time by Silver Blue Music after the Lovin'. Jay-Z also recorded one of Joel's Silver Blue Music copyrights, resulting in sales from his Black album of 33.5 million albums just in the USA. Joel produced recordings for Helen Reddy, James Darren, Ike Turner, Tony Orlando, Laura Branigan, Little Anthony, Righteous Brothers, Sister Sledge, Al Martino, Joe Pesci, and many more, in addition to producing three consecutive number one Sony albums on the Billboard Classical chart for the Five Browns. Joel was also a recording artist himself on five labels, including Casablanca, Motown, and Epic Records. Joel currently lives in Calabasas, California, and has several new and amazing projects coming up. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Joel Diamond. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I am in Calabasas, California, home of the Kardashians.
I was just thinking that, yes.
plus other familiar sounding people.
Let's dive in straight away. At what age did you feel cool? You want to be in this music, entertainment, creative world, whether as a teenager or a child. And how, I know it's a multi-decade journey, but how did that journey proceed and progress?
How about 9 years old?
Okay.
Do you ever see the movie Dirty Dancing?
Of course, yes. Yes.
Okay. Dirty Dancing was an exact replica of where I grew up. I grew up in New Jersey, and every summer we go to the Catskill Mountains, known as the Borscht Belt back then. And Dirty Dancing was an exact replica of what I lived through every summer in the Catskill Mountains, that they would have amateur night.
Yes.
And if you remember, the little girl got up on stage and she did her little Hawaiian dance.
Yes.
I would get up and sing.
Yes.
I'll get to sing my heart out 9 years old on amateur night. So, man, going back, I guess, yeah, that's a good question. You asked me, when do I first remember music or singing? I guess it was that. It was that time.
And then how did that progress? What were the next steps?
Oh, boy. Every Sunday at our house, my mom would play piano and my father would play his organ, which I still have here, his organ. And we'd have family over every Sunday. And I would sing for whoever was over. And I loved it, loved it, loved it. And as I got in through my teenage years, do you remember a show? Well, you know, you didn't have it over there, called American Bandstand.
We didn't have it, but I've heard of it and I know of it, yes.
American Bandstand was my go-to every afternoon. And not only was I addicted, I was living vicariously through these kids dancing on the show in Philadelphia with Dick Clark. And it was an amazing show. Every kid in America knew the names of the, they called the regulars.
Okay.
The regulars were the same kids that were on every single day. And again, vicariously, I lived through their life because I was always a nerd in school. My ear stuck straight out.
Okay.
And I was such a nerd. But this is my life, American Bandstand. And not only did I learn, and I knew every kid's name, but it was also, looking back, a great foundation for me, for my music, that I would listen, I would analyze, and they would have their top 10, and the kids would go on there. There would be interviews, and what do you think of that song by Frankie Avalon or Fabian or Bobby Rydell or Jimmy Darin? What do you think of those songs? And the kids would analyze. In my mind, I would analyze them at the same time. And I don't want to jump ahead, but I don't want to miss this connection here, Barrett. But I'll fill in the in-between. But 30 years later, I was living in a penthouse on Central Park South in New York City. And I get a phone call in the middle of the night. And is this Joel Diamond? Yes. Who is this? It's Arlene Sullivan. Arlene Sullivan was the most famous regular on American Bandstand.
Oh, wow.
And she was calling me. As it turned out, a friend of mine who was a casting director put her up to it. And, oh, my God, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. My eyes opened up like saucers. I said, Arlene Sullivan? And here I am already successful. Like I said, I'll fill in the gaps.
Yeah, yeah.
But here I was successful. And I was like a little kid. Arlene Sullivan. I asked her every question I ever wanted to know about Bandstand.
Okay.
What was it like? Where did you go after? Where did you go before? And what did, you know, all those questions. And believe it or not, I stayed in touch with her. And about 6 months later, 3 carloads of kids from Philadelphia, the regulars from Bandstand, came to visit me, have dinner at my house.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
It was the most, I had an elevator opened right into my apartment.
Yeah.
I'll never forget the minute the elevator door opened and American Bandstand was in black and white.
Yes.
So all of a sudden the door opens and all these kids, the regulars in living color, come walking out of my elevator and said, oh my God, I'm in heaven. And I have it right on my piano back here, better than any gold records I ever had. They gathered around me after the end of the evening, and they said, we just want to let you know that we were talking. We want to give you this trophy. And I have it right. It's better than any trophy I ever got. And the trophy says, to Joel Diamond, honorary American Bandstand regular.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And they said to me, Arlene, representing the whole group, Arlene said to me, we all said if we had known you back then, you would have been one of us. I mean, I had tears in my eyes.
Oh, well.
So that's the way I had to connect those two.
Yes, 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 of course. Yes. Now the next steps.
The next steps.
Yes.
So my dad, my father, always had my life scripted out for me. I finish high school. I go to college. Now, again, college, never leaving New Jersey. I went to Rider University in Trenton. And my dad said, now when you finish college, you'll go into the Army to do your stint. I said, okay, I don't want to get drafted. So I went to the Army. And again, Barrett, never leaving New Jersey. I was in Fort Dix, New Jersey. And then I went into the family business of insurance or real estate. And that was my script, you know, that I would take over the family business. My dad was quite successful. But doing that, little did I know how much I'd be learning all my life lessons from selling life insurance. I mean, that's it. If you could sell life insurance, man, you can sell anything. Because nobody wants to. Nobody wants to admit they're going to die. They don't want to buy your crap.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing that. And there was a gentleman from one of the life insurance companies who came into our office as a representative from that company. His name was George Meltzer. What a name, huh? George Meltzer said to me, "Joel, why don't we go out on a few calls together? And I'll teach you some of the things about, you know, how to sell other things, you know, different endorsements and riders about life insurance." Okay, George. So George and I spent a lot of time together. And George said to me, "Joel, what do you really want to do?" And I said to him, "George, if I had my choice in life, all I want to do, I want to be a singer. Mm-hmm. I want to sing. I mean, if somebody had told me back then that I was not going to be the next Steve Lawrence, I would have stuck my head in the oven. All I want to do is sing." So yeah. George said, "I'll tell you what." He said, "I have a trio." George plays accordion.
Okay.
So George said, "I have a trio. Every Saturday night, we play at the Holiday Inn in Wayne, New Jersey. I would play for weddings and bar mitzvahs." And George said to me, "How would you like to stand in and to sit in with us this coming Saturday night and sing?" I said, "Ooh, yeah." I said, "My God." I said, "This is exciting as hell."
Yeah.
I said, "Really?" Said, "Yeah." So I said, "Okay." So Saturday night couldn't come fast enough. So I went down to the Holiday Inn and I started singing with the George Meltzer Trio. You know, singing all the great wedding for weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was pretty good. And then just as a little anecdotal thing, one of the owners of the Holiday Inn at one point said to George, "Hey, George, this guy's singing. He's got to play an instrument. He can't just stand up there." So George and I concocted that. Okay, I went out and bought a bass guitar and a bass speaker. I had no idea how to play bass.
Yes.
I never plugged it in, but I stood there and went, I can't believe I was playing bass.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, it's not a dominant instrument anyway. It's just, you know, and by the way, also as a little side story, I was playing Saturday nights with George on alternate Saturday nights at the same Holiday Inn in Wayne, New Jersey, was an act called Vincent and Pesci. It was Joe Pesci. They were playing alternate weekends.
Yeah.
Joe would sing and Frank would do the comedy.
Okay.
And I got to know them quite well, which goes on too. So there was a guy downtown in New Jersey, Passaic, who's in a clothing business. I bought my clothes there. He said, "Are you still singing at the Holiday Inn?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "I have a customer who writes songs. Why don't I get you two together? Maybe you could sing his songs." I said, "Great. I'll meet him." The guy was filthy rich with money. And he said, do you sing?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, maybe you can sing some of my songs." Took me in the recording studio. Well, I'd never been in a recording studio before. And he was so wealthy, Barrett. Normally, a demo is piano, bass, and drums. He would bring string sections in and horn sections.
Yes.
He had so much money matter. And all of a sudden, I found myself singing with big orchestras. The songs were terrible. Then he said to me at one point, he said, "Do you know anybody in the music industry? Maybe you could help me get my songs recorded." And I always remember from my Dale Carnegie course, my father made me take, How to Win Friends and Influence People, always say yes. So I said to Arnold, "Of course I know people." I figured, yeah, always say yes, you'll figure out how to do it later. So I told my father I had to leave every afternoon. I went to New York City by bus, sat at the phone booth of the Americana Hotel, in the phone booth, fistful of dimes, yellow pages.
Yes.
And that was my office. And that was my office. Calling record companies. I was already a good salesman. So one guy at RCA Victor, RCA Records, every time I'd call him, he'd see me. But he would never buy a song for me because they're terrible songs. So he finally said to me, I was so sweet, and he became a major player in the A&R business. And he's a major player. And he said to me, he said, Joel, I feel so sorry for you. These songs, he said, allow me to buy a life insurance policy from you. And I sung him a life insurance policy.
Okay.
See what that is? So anyway, again, the short version. So I said to Arnold, who's the songwriter, I said, maybe I'll have better luck in Europe with your songs. I heard there's a big music convention going on. And he said, okay. And he said, how much? I told him how much. I figured out budget. He said, yeah, good. Well, yeah. I never left Passaic, New Jersey.
Okay.
here I was getting on a plane, going to France, Cannes, for the International Music Convention.
Yes.
I said, holy mackerel. So thank God, you know, I've had always a lot of good being at the right places at the right times. I sat next to this guy on a plane who was also going, nicest guy in the world. He said, is this your first time? I said, yeah, it's my first time on a plane, much less going to France. So he said, I'll help you when we get there. Nicest guy. His name was Bob Reno. He was the head of music publishing for Mercury Records. So he saw the way I was, once we got there, he introduced me to people and I started hustling around. He said, yeah, pretty impressive. Not that I knew what the hell I was doing, but it looked good, you know? So I got home 2 weeks later. So this is where the big leap takes place.
Mm.
I was 25 years old at the time, going on 26. So I'm home, phone rings. It was after dinner, having dinner with my parents, like I always did, the 25 years old. Getting ready to watch I Love Lucy for the night. So the phone rings. And it's Bob Reno calling me from New York. I said, whoa. I said, hi, Bob. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I just finished dinner with my parents. He said, come into New York right now. I said, right now? I said, yeah. I said, oh, I never drove into New York at night. So I drove into New York. I meet Bob Reno. And Bob says, you know, I was running the music publishing company for Mercury Records. And I just got promoted today to head of A&R, and they asked me to choose my own successor.
Yeah.
And Bob said to me, you are the least qualified, but I believe in you the most.
Wow.
And that was my first big job, not first, first job period,
yeah,
in the music industry, heading up the music publishing company for Mercury Records.
Once you did made that leap and was doing sort of more the behind the scenes in the music world, did you still carry on singing, or did your focus become solely more on the interactions with the artists that you were collaborating or producing or working with?
Perfect question. And the singing had to take the back seat for now.
Yeah.
Because all songwriters I was working with at the company. I mean, when I took over, Bob already had a staff of about 20 songwriters. And 2 weeks after I got there, I mean, it was such a big load for me to, you know, all these people. I called Bob upstairs at Mercury Records. I just think I need help. He said, I just had a guy come into my office. He just got dumped as a recording artist from Epic Records. You might want to see him. Maybe he could help you. His recording name was T.D. Valentine. I said, okay. So I met him. I hired him. He was my assistant for 2.5 years. And his real name was Tommy Mottola.
Okay. Yes.
Who became the longest running president of Columbia Records ever and married to Mariah Carey,
yes,
obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Tommy was my assistant. I gave him his first job in the music business.
Wow. You said you were in A&R, correct? This first position
Music publishing.
Music publishing. Okay. So for the listeners who do not know, what is music publishing?
Music publishing is the result of when somebody writes a song and they want to get it published by a music publisher.
Okay.
For several reasons, most of which the music publisher usually has great connections and contacts in the music business, which, by the way, obviously I did not. Because I'm coming from the insurance business.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was a quick learner, a fast learner. And that is the reason all these songwriters are up there writing.
Okay.
And
understood.
And unfortunately, they realized that I was a complete neophyte. I mean, I didn't know anything about it, but there was one writer that had so much confidence in me. And as it turns out, make a long, I'm trying to condense this one too. He played me one song one time, and I said, geez, this song would be great for Gary Puckett and the Union Gap. Remember Gary Puckett and the Union Gap? They were having one number one after number one after number one hit. And I said, this would be a great song. I said, this is a demo, piano vocal demo. So I said, let me run with the song. I took this demo. I sent it everywhere, Barrett. I sent it to his producer. I sent it to his record company. I sent it to his mother. I sent it to his house. I sent it everywhere until finally I got a call from Gary's producer, said, we just heard your song. This girl's a woman now. And I think we're going to record it. Not only did he record on the album, it became his best bit, like Gary Puckett's last hit single he ever had. And that was my first hit I ever had in the business.
So that's about being tenacious. You've got a very tenacious character like me. I'm the same as you. Keep going, keep knocking those doors. So your first role was in music publishing. What were the subsequent roles that you had within the industry? Were they always in music publishing, or what other avenues did you move into from there?
After Mercury Records Publishing, what happened was that the publishing company got absorbed into the mother company, and I was out of a job. I did get Tommy Mottola a job over at Chapel Music, where there were two unknown songwriters named Hall and Oates, who Tommy started managing. That the rest of his thing is history. But I was out of a job, so I was at some event, and I saw Clive Davis standing there talking to people. Like you, I'm tenacious, and there's a Jewish word, chutzpah,
Yes, I'm also
means.
Jewish, so I know that word.
Okay. I always had a lot of chutzpah.
Yes, I
And
like that. Me
so,
too.
I could tell. I could tell. So Clive's standing there talking, a whole group of people. I tap him on the shoulder. I said, Mr. Davis, my name is Joel Diamond, and I heard the head of your music publishing company at Sony is quitting. And I said, I'd like to apply for the job. And just to get rid of me, he didn't know who I was. He said, call my office tomorrow morning. Now, just get rid of me. So the next morning, I called early. I called his executive vice president. His name is Walter Dean. I said, Walter, I saw Clive last night. He told me to call you about the job running at Sony Music. He said, what you gonna say, no? So he said, okay, come on in. I'll interview you. And I got the job. And who was I replacing at the time? Who was the head of the publishing company? Tony Orlando. I replaced Tony Orlando. To this day, Tony's one of my dearest, sweetest, best friends to this very day, 50 years later. I just spoke to him last week. So then I worked there for about 2.5 years at Sony. I ran Sony Music. But what a training ground. My writers, my songwriters, Harry Nilsson, James Taylor, Melissa Manchester, Barry Manilow, writer. Now, have you ever heard of a singer named Laura Nyro? So I get a call from Laura Nyro's manager that he wanted to make an appointment to renew Laura's publishing contract with Sony. I said, yeah. And Clive called me and he said, Laura's coming in with her manager. I don't want to lose her because she was writing hit after hit. And Clive said, no matter what you have to offer them, I don't want to lose them. So in walks Laura with her then unknown manager, David Geffen. And that was David's first million-dollar deal he ever made. And he got $2 million and Laura got $2 million.
You've had a multi-decade interacting with so many artists, so many different in different spaces. So what do you do now? Are you retired or are you still hustling and having chutzpah?
The rocking chair is nowhere in my future.
Okay, good. I like that.
Well, I'm going to tell you what I do based on my next move from Sony. I got a call from Polydor Records offering me my own record label. So at that point, I started producing and writing. I had my own record, and I had like a string of big R&B hits after that. And then I got more and more into producing and getting a good reputation of producing. And I'm not going to bore you with the story how I got to Engelbert Humperdinck. To this day, I have produced 109 recordings for Engelbert Humperdinck, including the biggest hit he ever had in his entire career, and the only gold record he ever had in America. Even Release Me was not a gold record. Once I had a number one record with Engelbert, I got all of these artists coming to me, Al Martino, James Darren. I produced Helen Reddy's last album, and I had a huge monster hit with Gloria Gaynor, which to this day, it's her second biggest hit, Ty Will Survive, and according to Wikipedia and Google, is the worldwide gay anthem,
yes,
called I Am I Am.
Yes.
Is what I prefer. And then I won't bore you again with backstory, but I got the David Hasselhoff, who, yes, got turned down by every single record label, and I believed in him. And he visited me in my penthouse in New York. Now I'm living in a penthouse in New York City, top floor building on Central Park,
yes,
which, by the way, if you Google, I have a thing hanging on my wall here, sold last year the number one most expensive residential sale ever in America.
Wow.
$240 million, where I lived for 20 years. So David came up to see me only because he was engaged to a girl I used to date when she was 18 years old. So David came up to visit me, saw my gold records, said, all they ever wanted to do was sing. I said, David. And this was after Knight Rider,
yes,
before Baywatch. Before, okay, Baywatch.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So I said, David, I'm going to take money out of my pocket and I'm going to record you. I recorded them, and I have my record label all now it's Sony, my own record label, which I still do, by the way. And we put the album out, and it bombed. I mean, it bombed. I get a call 1 year later from the head of international Sony, and she said to me, do you know you have the number one album in Germany?
Germany, yes.
I actually had to ask Sarah, with who? I had no idea. She said, you're outselling Michael Jackson and Madonna combined.
Wow.
And we sold 4 million albums with David. And I created that whole thing in Germany for him.
There's so many stories and so many interactions. I'm loving this. So I know if I had to ask this question in 2 minutes, 2 years, 20 minutes, I know your answer will be different every time simply because there are millions of them. And I understand that and recognize that. If you had to push play to 5 songs by whomever artist wants to finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
The first one would be my idol, who you probably never heard of, Johnny Ray, a song called Cry. The other one would be the one I produced with Engelbert, After a Living, Gloria Gaynor, I Am What I Am. And I also had a big hit with One Night in Bangkok, which was my,
yes,
recording.
I love that song, and, yes.
I'm looking at this picture right here on the wall. And Tony Orlando allowed me, I'm the only one ever to have produced Tie a Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree.
Yes.
Second time, Tony. And that would be it.
Okay, so I'd like your observation around this. I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. I love the aesthetic of the holding. I love the journey and the experience of the receiving and the songs from one to whatever number. I'm sure you are aware that CDs, vinyls, and cassettes are making a massive comeback, but we've also got these digital platforms that people consume music on. What is your observations of where the industry is at the moment?
I think the industry, like many times before, and is always at a turning point. And for example, for me personally, I like to try to fill voids and fill holes. And I just signed a new artist, an R&B artist, a guy who is amazing. He'll be the next Luther Vandross. So I like to feel that I could contribute to the evolving of the music industry to get back to where it's all about the song again.
Yes.
And people remember songs. They're not going to remember beats, but they'll remember songs.
It's about filling the holes and reminding people about the experience of listening to that song. That's fantastic. Joel, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. We're going to definitely have a part 2 in a couple of months' time because I want to hear more of these stories. So I hope that's okay with you, but we'll be in touch. But
I got plenty of stories, and I hope maybe, so I know your podcast is really far-reaching. I would love to find somebody, Barrett, to help me write my story. As anybody out there in podcast land, I would love to find somebody to help me. Because I can't imagine. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, you need to write a book because I got stories forever.
What is your final message to the listening audience?
My final message is certainly not to be corny, but you never give up and you never let age be your cage.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.